So this is Deploy and Provision Best Practices with Microsoft Server 2016. My name is Jason Himmelstein.
I'm Todd Quint.
And we're going to talk to you guys. We're those SharePoint guys from Rackspace. Let's dive in. Hey, there's me again. So I am, again, Jason Himmelstein. I'm the Office 365 Services Advisory Services Manager for Rackspace. I'm also an Office Servers and Services MVP before the reclassification as a SharePoint MVP for a number of years. That's all my contact information. Feel free to tweet at me. That's an L, not a 1. It's SharePointlehorn. My blog up there, SharePoint Longhorn, that's where it was. I thought that Twitter handles were supposed to be long. I didn't know when we first started way back in the day. And that is me in front of a hobbit hole. Rackspace has done some great things for me, and one of them was getting me down to Australia to do some work with some of our awesome customers down there. And while I was down there for a weekend, I popped over to New Zealand and got that beautiful, pretty picture. So,
yeah, actually, it was a cost-cutting measure. They made him stay in a hobbit hole. We couldn't. So this is me. I'm Todd Quint. I'm also a SharePoint MVP. Do some speaking, do some writing. How many of you guys have any of the 2010 or 2013 admin books? So I've gotten a number of questions this week about whether there will be a 2016 book coming out. I hope you all deal well with disappointment. We will not be writing a 2016 version of the book. These things move so fast. Even we wrote this deck last week, and even things have changed since then. And so we just decided not to write a book this time around. But I have a blog at toddquint.com. You can go out there. I blog about stuff, SharePoint, gadgets, and all that, just all the Microsoft things. You can hit me up on Twitter, at Todd Quint. I wasn't clever enough to come up with anything that wasn't just my name. I didn't have Jason's creativity.
Well, Jason Himmelstein was already gone on Twitter.
Is there a cooler Jason Himmelstein on Twitter?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but he definitely causes me some problems with background checks.
And then every week I do a live podcast, 5 o'clock Eastern, 4 p.m. Central on Mondays, and just talk about what's happened the previous week, what things have come out, what I've worked on. You can get that. It's also on YouTube and all that. And that, so Jason made the previous vanity slide. We put this deck together, and I had something that looked like my 6-year-old put it together on PowerPoint, so I had somebody make me this one. It's my car at a car show a couple years ago. One of the fun things, one of my guilty pleasures, I watch American Idol, and several years ago, Keith Urban had the t-shirt that had the Trans Am Firebird giving the horns, and I'm like, I need me one of those. So that is that. So, and I also work at Rackspace, so hit me
there
up.
There you go. So let's talk agenda for a couple of minutes, because I think it's important to let you know what you're in for, and why you want to stay all the way to the end, not just for little camera lenses
not
and stuff like that.
Not just for the camera lenses.
So we're going to cover infrastructure design. We're going to talk all about you know, what to consider, what to think about when it comes to planning SharePoint. We'll talk about SQL performance. It's really important, kind of the brains of SharePoint, so we're going to talk about that as well. And then we're also going to talk about some SharePoint performance stuff. Everybody ready? Excited?
Yeah.
There we go. That's the reaction I was hoping for.
Before we go too much further, how many of you have already installed SharePoint 2016 on-prem? That's a good chunk. You guys are some trendsetters. Is everybody else 2013? People that just like to raise their hands. Okay, that's good. All right.
People who love the lunch. No, none. Oy. Okay.
Chick-fil-A is doing a killing in this building.
They really are. The lines were so long. Yeah. I think there were more people online than there are in
Absolutely.
The room.
Yeah. So the good news is, even if you've got something installed, a bunch of the tips we're going to give you in the next hour are applicable. You're going to learn stuff. It's going to be great.
All right. So let's go ahead and dive into infrastructure design. So the first things first, when it comes to planning SharePoint, you need to understand what the customer requirements are. This is important because I've talked to a lot of customers. Yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and put a couple of these more things up here on the board. I think that might be the last one. So I've talked to a lot of customers over the years, and a lot of what I've heard from those customers is, hey, I want high availability, I want disaster recovery, I have, I want 5 nines of uptime. Okay, great. What does that actually mean to you, customer? What does that mean in your world? And I asked one of these customers one time what he meant by high availability. And his response verbatim was, it has to be up and operational from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. with no more than a 30-minute downtime window during the day.
High availability.
That, to him, was high availability.
It's really turning the screws to
us. It really depends upon what your customers are looking for. If you have customers that are on all the time, and they're on 24/7, high availability is going to mean something different than to somebody who only needs it up from during business hours. So when you're planning it, understand what the customer requirement is around that. Then talk about disaster recovery with them. What does that mean? Because high availability is great, but what happens when that highly available SharePoint farm and you're doing all that writing back and forth with SQL always on, and you've got really great speeds and everything's awesome, and you get database corruption? Goes everywhere. That database corruption is prevalent all over the place. So you have to worry about that disaster, not just high availability, but you have to plan for that disaster situation as well. So understanding what the RPO and RTO, that recovery point objective and the recovery time objective, what are those? What can the customer suffer from a downtime and how much data can they lose? That's important. You have to understand that. Some customers, they can't lose 5 minutes worth of data or they're losing $1 million.
Yeah, and what we have found out through our many years is that corrupt databases back up just fine, replicate just fine, restore just fine. So you have to have all that planned out, practice it, test it. You gotta know what it means to your business.
So, the other thing I really love when people come and say, I want 5 nines of uptime. Awesome. I start sketching, I go, what's the budget for the project? I got about $50. Okay, you can have a 5, or you can have a 9. One or the other there, because that's about all $50 is going to get you. You have to understand the budget that your customer has, the budget that your internal IT team has in order to be able to do these things, because you have to set expectations right. The customer is going to want something, that's great, but if they've only got this much money, they're only going to get this much infrastructure, right? They're only going to get this much performance. You have to have that conversation up front and set the expectation right if you like keeping your job. So, location awareness. Understand where people are, okay? I had somebody who came to me and said, our performance is absolutely terrible. Said, okay, what's wrong with it? I've been monitoring, everything looks great. Page times are loading in sub-second. Everything's great, what's wrong? Well, I have salespeople in mainland China, they're using dial-up. Okay. I can't change the speed of copper wire going back from mainland China back to a data center in Chicago. That's just not something I can help you with. So understand what the requirements are around data location, data sovereignty, your customer location, and all of those things come together in order to give you that plan for what your infrastructure starts to look like. Okay? And lastly, number of concurrent users. If I have 100,000 employees in my company and I start planning for 100,000 concurrent users, and I have a project that really only needs 50 users to be concurrent, I've built a big, awesome, beautiful SharePoint farm that I love that nobody is using to anywhere near its capacity. So before you start spending all of that money, understand what those things are gonna look like, because you may only need a medium-sized farm for something before you go building this beautiful, awesome, large topology estate.
Yeah, and the flip side of that is, that same company, 100,000 users, uses SharePoint a lot. You build it for 100,000 users, how long is that gonna be in place? Is that company on the upswing? Are you gonna need to be able to support 120,000 users in a couple of years? Do you wanna deal with that now while you've got the money, or do you wanna come back a year later and say, remember all that money we needed? We need some more. Things to think about. I mean, you know how your requisition stuff works and all that, but you gotta think, you know, in both directions. Who's going to use
it? And there's a new game, new part of the game too at this point, and that's hybrid. What's the plan for hybrid in your organization? What are you looking at? Am I going to SharePoint Online in the next year? Do I need to be scaling all the way, or should I be starting that plan right now? How should I be dealing with that? Those are the things that talking to the customer, talking to your IT department, and making sure that the business is invested is the right thing and the right way to go. So a couple things about basic 2013 topology.
This is the topology that we've all known and loved. Our SharePoint 2010 topology probably looked a little bit like this. 2007 probably looked a little bit like this. And so one of the things that we want to caution you with is when you're installing 2016, there's a bunch of things we're going to talk about later in this deck that are different. So resist the temptation of just copying your 2013 topology and go, you know, this thing has been sturdy for us for 3 years. It's done us well. It's stayed up. We're going to do the same thing. We're going to put a couple of web servers up there, load balance them, put a couple of app servers in. They're going to be fine. We're going to mirror our databases. Take a step back, do the things that Jason and I talked about in the previous slide, and start, you know, kind of start from scratch with 2016 with some of the things that we're going to talk about. Because it might look something like this. So we've got a bunch of information here coming up in some slides about scaling and all that. But now SharePoint 2016 makes it a lot easier to break out the distributed cache. How many of you guys have gotten bitten by the distributed cache in 2013? Remember back in the day in SharePoint 2010 when we thought the user profile service was finicky? Remember those days? Oh, we were so young and naive. And then we got the distributed cache in 2013, and I longed for the days I was doing battle with the user profile service. The good news is in SharePoint 2016, they've kind of broken that out. They've improved that a little bit. So we have better options around that, not having all the problems, not having it get corrupted, things like that. In 2016, they've made it easier to break out the search roles. We're going to talk about a couple of aspects of that in later slides about how to break it out and make sure that everything's running correctly and how to get it just out of your farm completely and what that means to your topology and your scaling when you make those kind of decisions. You want to hit the next one?
Yeah.
Oh, this is another good one. How many of you guys get to enjoy Project Server? Isn't it just a little darling? Isn't it? Yeah.
I'm sorry.
How many of you that are using it have it in its own farm? Right, so there's a lot of good reasons to put it in its own farm in previous versions of SharePoint. There were licensing issues. If you had just a few people using Project, there were patching issues. And this is another one of those things. When you hear people complaining about patching SharePoint, you think to yourself, they've never patched Project, have they? They've just never done it because it's really rough. So in 2013, it was a bad experience in 2010. In 2016, Project is built in. For better or for worse, it's built into the server code. So if you've got Project Server 2013 and you're going to upgrade that and bring that forward, you need to rethink that also. You need to say, okay, do I want to keep these two farms separate where there are technical reasons for it, where there are political reasons for it, and start thinking about whether it makes sense to bring that into one farm or not. Everything works. If you've got, you know, a subset of your users are licensed for Project, you just have to make sure they're licensed in your new farm. But now it is just a proper service app instead of 2016.
Which is really great. Because my favorite reason for keeping things separate in the 2013 world was because it made SharePoint a lot more performant when Project Server just wasn't there. So if you could just like knock that thing off altogether, all the better. Now it's a part of 2016, it's properly a service application, it's a much better world.
Yeah.
So from a logical planning perspective, understanding where the services belong, let's leverage MinRoll for that. And we're gonna talk in depth, Todd made a comment to me this morning, wow, we have a lot of MinRoll slides. It's because it's important. And we're gonna cover MinRoll pretty well in depth because there's some changes that happen in, as a part of Feature Pack 1 that have been talked about at this conference that you're not gonna hear about up until this week. So we wanna make sure that we've covered it off and giving you guys a good perspective on it.
Yeah.
So from a site collection perspective, you do have to upgrade your 14.5 mode site collections to 15 mode before you do the content database attach into a 2016 environment. Otherwise, it just no va, no go.
Yeah, so the 14.5, we kind of put that as a joke. When you upgrade from SharePoint 2010 to 2013, you have the option of leaving your 2010 site collections in 2010 mode or 14 mode, and then upgrading your site collections onesie, twosie as you've got time. You also have the opportunity in 2013 to create new 2010 site collections. Microsoft did this so that you could upgrade the back end, upgrade the server bits, before you properly trained all your users and gotten all your, you know, branding and all that figured out. It worked fairly well. The differences between 2013 and 2016 from a UI perspective, from a look and feel, aren't quite as great. So Microsoft decided to go ahead and upgrade that from 2013 to 2016. But what won't happen is 2010 mode site collections will not upgrade to 2016, and they will block an upgrade when you attach to those databases. So if you're in 2010 now or 2013, do a get SP site, look at your compatibility level, and see if you've got any running at 14. If you do, you're gonna have to upgrade those before you move to 2016 or at
Yeah, and you can also go, and now that it's already online, actually, you can go and watch our session from Tuesday. It's already there. Our Dussel tones are out there for you to go hear the whole thing. Slides are out there as well. So go ahead and go watch that if you want the deeper dive into the upgrade migration story. Oop, I thought I hit the button. So MinRoll, everybody excited about, oh, we have a question. If you have, can you come up to the mic? Is there any chance? That's okay, go ahead, we'll repeat it. So there.
So feature upgrade, I didn't hear the back half of that.
So the question is about visual upgrade. So what happens if you're running in 2010 mode on a 2013 server and you all are still in the visual upgrade state? You do need to flip over.
Yeah,
Yes.
Yep, everything's got to be full 2013. And I don't think you can run 2007 visual upgrade on 2010 and 2013. The short answer is you got to be at 2013 mode all the way across the board to move your site collection to 2016.
So it's something that can be done without the users having to see it. You can go ahead and do that, you know, in another environment at that time. You can go ahead, pull it over into a QA, flip it up, and then migrate if you're taking a proper backup and if you're using any of the tooling that's out there as well. So, Minroll.
So one of the big changes for us on-prem folks in SharePoint, so Jason and I have been doing SharePoint since when dinosaurs ruled the earth and SharePoint pages were rendered on stone tablets. It was a dark time. But the product was always built as an on-prem product, 2001, 2003. And about 2007 is when Microsoft really started pushing this cloud thing. So they took SharePoint 2007 and they kind of banged on it and wedged it in and used the shoehorn and they turned it into BPOS, a cloud version of SharePoint 2007. But it was really an on-prem product, and it had all kinds of rough edges. And then SharePoint 2010 came out, and it was also designed as an on-prem product. And they did the same thing. They wedged it in, and they pushed, and they nailed it and hit it and turned it into SharePoint Online in the cloud. Same with 2013. In 2016, though, about 2.5 years ago, the team completely changed focus. And they said, for this version of SharePoint On, we will design it as a cloud product that happens to work on-prem. So then that kind of started in the 2013 frame. So what that results in is there's a lot of things that are coming down to us on-prem that are things that Microsoft had to do to make it work in the cloud. And Minroll is one of many of those things. So if you ever see something weird in SharePoint, you're like, why did they make this decision? Ask yourself, does this help them host it as SharePoint Online? It's probably the answer. So one of them was Minroll. And Minroll, imagine, you know, so who here has a large SharePoint farm? Who thinks they've got a big one? Okay, so let's start the bidding at 10 servers. Okay, 15, 20. Are we gonna be here all day if I keep going up by fives? Shout out a high number.
243.
In one farm, one farm, all sharing the same config DB. 200 sharing the same config DB.
I can't buy you a drink right now, but
sir,
I can at least throw this to you. So
sir,
you
could you come up here and tell us a little bit about scaling SharePoint? Because I
get in the mic.
So when you're, holy crap, when you're dealing with farms that size and the size of SharePoint Online, keeping track of your servers and keeping track of how many have different roles and all that becomes a completely different task than when you're running a regular size farm that's, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 servers. And Microsoft realized that they needed something like Minroll to keep track of all these SharePoint Online farms. Jason, tell them a little bit about Minroll.
So the great thing about Minroll is that it's self-healing. You specify, and by the way, Minroll is not an install setting, it's a configuration setting. So Minroll can be changed down the line. Okay, so this is not something you're locking yourself into for life. This is something that you can go back to PowerShell and make a configuration change later. So as you figure out what you're setting up your farm as, you can go ahead and say, I'm gonna specify these specific roles, and then, you know, I've figured out I really need more or I need less of certain size, so I can move those around. I can go back and reconfigure those. But Minroll really is self-healing as well. So specifically, as you're taking a look, it actually gives you a health rating of the server. Okay. As you're patching, it says whether or not it is compliant with all of the patches that are out there. Okay. So Minroll is designed for you to be able to take a look at a dashboard and see, is this server in compliance? Is it healthy? Is it not? Okay.
And let's take a step back. So what Minroll is it a framework for making sure that you have servers running specific roles inside of your farm. And we're going to get into those roles in a minute. But basically, when you've got 200 servers like this gentleman over here does, do you have heart medication as well, sir? And absolutely, okay. So it lets you say, okay, I need to make sure I have a certain number of web servers, but I don't want to go in and click all that and make sure that's working. I've got this web server role. I've got this application server role. So they've broken everything out, and they've guaranteed if you have one of every one of these roles, everything in SharePoint will work. So it's easy to go in and see what's going on. Quick question, sir?
Can you switch from custom to Minroll?
So his question is, can you switch from custom to whatever? Like Jason said, when you define a server's Minroll, it is completely flexible. At any point, anywhere, you can change any machine's Minroll from one thing to anything else. And we'll get into that later in the thing.
So yes.
Yes, yeah. So short answer.
Long answer, short answer. All right. So again, it is adaptable. It gives you that capability. So what are the server, what are the core server roles? Well, we've got web front end, or just front end, application server, distributed cache, and search. Okay, we're gonna talk about mini min role here in a little bit. Yeah, it's a fun name. But for right now, we're gonna talk about these as the four core search services, four search roles. Golly, I'm talking wrong here. Four core min role roles. I was looking at the word search.
Let me tell you. So the front end one is the one that your users hit. And this is, you know, it's what renders pages. The other thing that they have done that's part of this is they have made sure that if a user hits a page, it's we're in the web front end role, every service app request that that user makes, if that server that they're on has that service, it will always use it. So that keeps you from bouncing over to another server, keeps things moving more quickly, but also keeps you from hitting a server that might not be online right now because they know that the server's online, they know that it's working. So the web front end, the front end role, all the end user stuff, page rendering, those kind of things.
So the application server does what we have referred to as the robot services, all the back end services, all the timer jobs, search crawls, things of that nature, all those things that are not being handled by the front end. All the bits are on all the servers though, so it's only turning up the services that it needs. So that server's only gonna have those roles that it needs only within that role. All the services that it needs within that role are gonna be turned up. So the distributed cache service role is going to do just the distributed cache, and search is going to run the search services such as query and index.
So on 2013, have you guys had a server the distributed cache took all the memory and killed everything? Yeah, so the memory management is crazy, and I think in 2013, you could actually give distributed cache too much memory, and it would actually run more slowly if you gave it too much RAM. And so when you tried to have it, you had to have it on. You needed it for search, you needed it for social, you needed it for authentication. The ability to now put this on its own server so that it only strangles itself and doesn't hurt anything else, this one is great. And make sure that it's all configured perfect. Love this one.
So there are two additional roles. One is the single server farm role, and the other is custom. So single server farm, we're gonna talk about why that's not a bad thing. It's not a scary thing, this is okay. Here in just a minute, but all the services run on the single server, okay? Now, you have to be domain joined, and you have to have a separate SQL server, okay? You have to install it separately. It's no longer installing the evil small version of SQL.
Yeah, how many of you guys have done a single server install in a previous version of SharePoint? Okay, was it by accident, or do I start making fun of people? So the previous single server from the back to the dark days of SharePoint was this horrible installation that used SQL Express and used local accounts and gave bad web app names. But like this version, it had this restriction that you couldn't add more servers to the farm. They didn't want you scaling out with this. But the way that they handled it was not a check of how many servers were in the farm. In code, they just disabled the ability to add a server to the farm. So I had a customer that called me once, having problems with SharePoint, couldn't get SharePoint to work, trying to add a server, it wouldn't work. They had, unbeknownst to them, installed it in single server mode. The server had been wonky, so they decided to take it out of the farm and add it back in. They were half right. They were able to take it out of the farm, but they couldn't add it back in. So all of the stuff was there, but they had done this horrible single server install, and by code, it just would not let them add their server back into its own farm. And they're like, what now? What do we do? So it was just a horrible thing before. And while I applaud Microsoft for taking out this terrible SQL Express-based version of SharePoint, I wish they'd have given it a different name.
I do too.
So his question was, we call out that you have to install SQL separately. Does it need to be on a separate box or just a separate install? It can be on the same machine. You just have to install it manually. It doesn't have the built-in one.
So you do need to make sure that things are configured properly, you have enough RAM on that box, that you've gone and set SQL the right way. All of that stuff has to be done.
Yeah, point of view.
So then there's custom role. I like to refer to custom role as fear of min role.
Yes.
Okay. This is what we went ahead and did when we didn't know what the heck min role really was when it first came out. We thought we needed 72 servers to do min role, and so we just said custom role, a lot easier, I could just do everything I want. I really don't see a whole lot of reasons to do a custom role in the worlds that I play in these days. They're there for third-party services that haven't integrated into MinRoll yet, and you know, MinRoll doesn't look at the server at all. It knows that it's in the farm. You know, the SharePoint knows it's in the farm, but MinRoll just looks at it and goes, server, next.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a second. When you're running MinRoll, the way that SharePoint keeps everything going is it's got a list inside of its head that says, okay, if JSON has a web front end, we always need that foundation web front end. You guys know each other? You can get up and sit by him if you want to. All right. It says, if you've got a web front end role defined, we always have to have that foundation web application service instance running. So in central admin, this is the application setting, services on server, that kind of deal. And there's a timer job that out of the box only runs once a day. I'd like to think it should be a little more aggressive, but once a day and says, okay, show me all the servers in the farm, show me what their MinRoll role is, and then I'm going to go make sure that all the service instances for that role are turned on. So for a web front end, it's going to be the foundation services. For the search services, it's going to be that. For distributed cache, it's going to be that. And it makes sure it trues up everything, so if something crashes or gets shut off, one of your college interns goes in there and shuts everything down, this will turn it back on. The other thing that it does, though, and this is the insidious one, is it goes and shuts everything off that shouldn't be running on that server. And so this is where custom comes in, because if you install some custom code, something that has its own service instance, when MinRoll, when that job runs once a day, it's going to shut off all the things that it doesn't think should be on that server. So it works in both directions.
So for years, I've heard Todd, before I started presenting and working with Todd, I heard him talking about the single server farms.
It was a horrible thing.
How bad it was, and there was this term that was used about killing kittens at one of the presentations. So much so that he said it so often that Christian Buckley made a t-shirt of it. So the question is, does single server kill kittens now? And the answer is no. This is a good thing. This is not a bad thing. This is for the developer world. This is for testing, right? Yeah. Do not do it for production, please. This is everything pre-production you can use this for. But it's not a bad thing. What do we have to have? Again, it's important to call it out because it's good. It's not a bad thing. I like developers a little. So this is for them, right? So make sure that SQL's installed separately. You have to have it there. It has to be domain joined, and you can use the config wizard, or better yet, you can use PowerShell to configure it properly.
Yep, and you don't have to worry for your kitten. Keep him in the room with you.
Kitten's healthy. Kitten's safe.
It's all good.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about some of these farm topologies, because we're talking about the infrastructure layer here, and we're going to spend just a few minutes in here, and then we're going to move on. So a MinRoll single server farm, anybody want to guess how many servers? We're not giving away a lens for this.
Oh, we're not. Okay. This is a tough one.
You can, if you want. Well, it's on the screen already, so it's one. You can only have one. Again, can't add any more to it. The minimum from a MinRoll perspective, this is Feature Pack 1, for those of you who are in the pre-Feature Pack 1 world, which is all of us right now.
Unless you're a time traveler from November or later. Anybody? No? All right. No time travelers?
It's like being a cop. You have to tell us.
Yeah. That's the first rule of time traveling. You got to tell us if you're a time traveler.
So that requires the four roles, okay, in order to be MinRoll compliant. In order to be high availability compliant, I'm tripping over my tongue, you have to have 8. So what I used to refer to back in the 2013 days of a two-column, three-tiered farm, we're now in this, what I would refer to as a two-column, five-tier farm, right? So we have to have all this because I'm including SQL in that space.
Yeah.
So that's how you get to high availability. In order to do the zero downtime patching, or is affectionately known as ZDP, you do have to have the full high availability MinRoll compliant server set up.
Well, let's step back for a second. So for the four servers, if you have those four servers like Jason has in that slide, you get 100% of all of SharePoint's functionality. Everything's there. Microsoft has said if you have one of each, you get everything. There's no, this doesn't work, that doesn't work. That four will get you. Jason was talking about ZDP, the zero downtime patching. We've got a couple slides on that later.
I think we have one.
So while Jason is correct that you need to have, you know, more than one of everything, obviously, because you can't not have downtime if you've only got one web front end. ZDP does not technically require MinRoll, so you could do all custom roles or something like that. It doesn't check for MinRoll, so don't think, we're not using MinRoll, we've got some customs, we can't do ZDP. You can, it doesn't technically require MinRoll, but it requires enough of everything.
Thank you, good cop.
So the other thing we wanted to mention, we've got an asterisk next to distributed cache, not just because we like asterisks, but because the distributed cache works a little differently when it comes to highly available. The distributed cache is a way for SharePoint to deal with things quickly, input, search requests, authentication, and kind of keep it as a cached buffer before it gets written to the database and spread across. It does not make itself fault tolerant. So if you have two distributed cache servers, and you patch one and you reboot one, the distributed cache functions will continue to happen, so you won't have any downtime. But what will not happen is the first distributed cache server that you patch, it will not copy its contents to the other one just when you reboot it. They're not fault tolerant like that. So those of you that have done battle with the distributed cache, you know you have to gracefully shut it down, and that's the thing that you do, stop distributed cache, blah, 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 and it flushes itself to disk and all that. You still need to do that with this. It doesn't do it across. We had a quick question. Quick, sir?
Hi. Just I have one question. Does Microsoft is also modified any app architectural model on the 2016 version of the SharePoint, or is the same like 2013?
Does it modify any of the what?
App model. You know the app model was released
app
on the...
App model?
Yeah.
Does the distributed cache modify the app model?
No, no. It's not related to the distributed cache. It's a separate services like the app services, app model. So is there any enhancement in terms of the app model? Like earlier we have a three kind of the app like...
Oh, so his question was, are there any enhancements to the app model in 2016?
Yes.
I don't think there are.
So, yeah, we're not...
Same as it, whatever the app model was on SharePoint 20.
So the app model is just a web front end. It's kind of different from what we're talking. Come up afterwards, and we'll chat about that.
Okay.
We'll chat about that.
Do we have time for one more, or you think we should...
Sure.
Don't skip ahead.
So his question was, can I run more than one role on one server? You, sir, that is a good segue. We call this the building anticipation portion of the thing. We will answer that question in a couple of slides.
Yeah, once we get to 11, we'll be
yep. So this is the RTM version of MinRoll. So before we go any further, how many of you are using MinRoll today in your SharePoint 2016 farms? Okay, so a few of you, probably more than I would have thought. Those of you that aren't, is it because you don't have the 4 or 8 servers that you think you need? Is it because you're a little trepidation around MinRoll? How come you're not embracing it just yet? Not enough servers? Not enough servers? Okay. Yeah, he can't fit it in. So you just copied your previous topology? All right. Shame on you, but okay. I appreciate your honesty. All right. So let's take it off.
So let's take the covers off. Here you go. This is Mini MinRoll. This is a part of Feature Pack 1. Microsoft is listening. This is pretty awesome stuff. This is what they announced this week. And now we have first-class support for small and medium farms. We have the ability to run 2 roles on the same server. They're very specific.
Yep.
We'll get to that here in just a couple minutes on another slide. But actually, I think it's right there. Front end with distributed cache.
Or that slide right
and
there.
Application with search.
I've seen it both ways. Yeah, so basically what happened here is Microsoft came up with MinRoll and like, this is the greatest thing. Sliced bread's got to be start looking behind its back. This is a pretty good thing. But they didn't think that not everybody has 200 server farms like this guy. And so for the rest of us out there that only have, 3 or 4 servers, MinRoll was not valuable to us. And so we gave them that feedback and they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, we should do that. So now we have this ability to combine some roles. It's going to be on another slide, I hear.
Later. So it also though, fills in some of the documentation gaps that are out there. Microsoft has done a really good job in Feature Pack 1 of documenting a lot of this stuff and putting it out there. It's all going to be out there on TechNet for you to go take a look at once you get home. But the ability to do this, it's really important to take a look at and go, Microsoft for years put things out there in these really slow cadences to bring to market. Not only did they bring this to us the first time out of the gates, of them doing a feature pack, but they brought it to us months sooner than they were planning to, which is pretty awesome. So they are actually really listening to us. The feedback that you're giving out at SharePoint.uservoice.com is being listened to, and man, it's a good feeling walking down the halls of Redmond and hearing people actually saying, we're implementing the things that you guys have been asking for. It's pretty cool.
They like to do that thing that I do with my boss at work and, my wife at home, under-promise and over-deliver. So on May the 4th, when they released the product, I think Jeff Tepper said that within a year, at the beginning of 2017, they were going to release this feature pack that was going to have some features. November. We only have to wait another month and a half. So yeah, good stuff.
So this is what the config wizard looked like, that PS config, the gray wizard, looks like at RTM. Pretty straightforward, pretty simple. This is similar to what we've seen in the past. The new wizard, there we go, we have those shared roles. So we're actually able to configure this here. You can also do it through PowerShell because it hasn't come out yet. We don't have a screenshot of that to share with you. But this is the screenshot that we have of what the new config wizard is going to look like. But there is gonna be the ability to do PowerShell for this as well.
Yeah. So how many of you have dealt with this with PowerShell, the mineral stuff? Yeah, it snuck up on me the first time. So I wrote a bunch of scripts in SharePoint 2010 to create farms and add servers to farms. And it was, you know, new SP configuration database, blah, blah, blah. The one I wrote for 2010 worked perfect for 2013, feeling like a champ. 2016 comes out. I try that same script for 2016. Doesn't work. Why is that? I have to specify the min role. So if you use PowerShell to add machines to a farm or to create a farm in 2016, you need to add that local server role function. And it's got hard to find roles. So the trick you can use, I use -L tab, that does the local server role. And then PowerShell will tab complete the role name for you. So you don't need to know what the names are. You can set tab, 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 and it'll go web front end, application search, cache, all that. So when the new stuff comes out in November, I assume that'll be the way we'll figure out what those other new names are.
I'll take one here.
Yes, sir. His question was, is it possible to ditch MinRoll and use DSC instead of this? I think of DSC as more of an installation thing and less of a maintenance thing for SharePoint. I mean, I realize for other, so there are DSC projects for, there's a bunch of them out there. I would use this. DSC is a PowerShell thing. This is the SharePoint team writing SharePoint stuff for SharePoint. I would use this instead.
Yeah, DSC is great for doing the install. That's where I'd leave it.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Yeah, so another thing, and we've hit it a bunch, but it bears repeating. The min role is not an installation feature. When you run the installation for SharePoint, put the code in and all that kind of stuff, this is not that. This is a adding the server to the farm thing. So all the bits are there. So this is when you add the server to the farm. And then again, you can change it at any time. You're not locked in to anything. We got a question down here, quick.
Ah.
Yes. Yes. So his question was, if you have a farm that is set up as a single server farm, which is not going to scale for production, what options do you have? I have not done it. Do you know if you can convert single server to custom and then add more servers?
So I'm going to, I haven't done it myself, but my understanding is that what you want to do is you want to stand up additional servers so that they're ready to go ahead and do the installation configuration. You've already done the installation configuration at that point to be able to add them into the farm. At that point, you can convert your min role single server to a front end at that point or to an application server. It's going to house CA at that point, obviously, because it already has it. But again, this is a configuration, not an installation. So all the bits are there. It's not like in the olden days where you went and installed, standard and you didn't have enterprise.
Yeah. So I've done a bunch of different min role conversions when I played with it. I'm not sure if I've done one from single server to custom or something else. That's the first thing I would try. And the good news about that is that you can go back to your farm and try to convert your single server to custom, and one of two things will happen. Either it won't work and you'll know immediately that you can't convert it, or it will work and it'll go custom and everything will keep working. So you've really got nothing to lose. And I can say that as the guy whose farm it isn't, but I think you'll be fine.
So we showed you a slide that looked very similar to this before, but this is the new mini min role. People have called it min role V2, or just as Microsoft is calling it now, min role.
Min role enhancements, yeah.
Yes,
so
yeah.
I like Microsoft's thing, calling the new one min role, and then I like to call the old one maxi min role, because it takes more servers. That really hasn't caught on, though.
No, I like the min role, because I like the Dr. Evil and Mini-Me visualization that it gives me. Because people really did think that it was evil, and in the last movie, he becomes good. So, hey, it's a good story. Sorry if
ending.
I ruined that for anybody. Hopefully you've seen all the Austin Powers movies. So again, we've had this up here on the slide for a minute. In a non-HA way, you actually can go down to two servers now. In an HA way, you can go to four servers now, right? because we have those combined roles.
Yep, and I don't think we actually called those out. So the two roles that you can combine in any comp, well, you can combine the web front end to distributed cache, which honestly, in 2013, you were probably already all doing anyway. And then you can combine application with search. Those are the only two that you can have. So the question earlier, can we combine roles on a server? The answer is yes, after November, and only web front end with a distributed cache or application with search. Now, in the farm, you can have different combinations of those. You know, you can have web front end and web front end with distributed cache, all that. But those are the only two pairs that you can have. Yes?
Given the issues you just mentioned about distributed cache, is it
recommended to combine? He said, given the issues with distributed cache, is it best to combine or to keep it separate? It depends on the size of your farm. I mean, the thing about distributed cache that got people was we're all SharePoint administrators, and distributed cache was part of like a programmery thing. Not going to get into that a bunch, but we just didn't know how to handle it. Like, we didn't know you had to go in and gracefully shut it down, because there's nothing else in SharePoint that's ever required that. So because of that, as SharePoint administrators, we would do the thing on our SharePoint servers, we'd reboot it, and we'd have problems with distributed cache and not know why. So it's not inherently evil at this point anymore, but if you've got the hardware and you've got the load, that's not a bad one to move out.
So if we go back a slide, there's a reason why the dedicated roles are still there.
Yeah.
Right? This is, you know, you can do it this way. You can. Microsoft is putting it in the config wizard. It's putting it in psconfig.exe. We can do this. It's supported. It's approved. They still say,
according to
HOIL, we recommend that you separate these roles. So this is a way of Microsoft responding to the need of the smaller business not to have to have as many servers. So the answer is yes, if you can separate it out, do it. But if you can't, there's another option for you.
Yep.
So anyway, we're going to move on from this. The HA side of things, you can see all that up there. From a search perspective, there are two discrete ways of doing it. You can do the traditional search service application on-prem and call everything on-prem and make it the same way, or you can now use the cloud search service application. You want to talk about this one? I know you're excited.
I do like this one. How many of you guys have played with the hybrid or the cloud search service application? Isn't it dreamy? I love it. So this is a thing that Microsoft snuck out last year. Comes in 2016 RTM. For those of you that are still proudly running SharePoint 2013, if you have the August 2015 cumulative update or later, you can also enjoy this. This is a new search service application that you install on-prem, and it does crawling on-prem. So crawling is the part where that, crawling is that task that goes out, you know, however often, and grabs every document out in SharePoint, grabs every document in your file share, and does whatever. It grabs them all. The crawl is on SharePoint, but here's where the magic happens. Instead of indexing on-prem, and the index is the part where like the monkey takes the coconut and bangs it on a rock to see what's inside, get all the words and all that out, the indexing happens up in SharePoint Online, happens in Office 365. There's two main values of this, and one has a lot to do with why we're talking about it in this discussion. With older versions of SharePoint and 2016 with on-prem search, that index box, wherever you put that index role, needed about this much disk space. And nobody knew how much disk space it needed. As a consultant, I got all the time, as we're working on topologies, how much space should I dedicate to the index? Well, I mean, it's kind of art. It's like, well, how big is your corpus going to be? How big do you think it's going to be in a couple of years? What kind of documents is it going to be? Because, you know, 100 gig of video files is going to have a much different sized index than 100 gig of text documents. I mean, there's just a lot of that kind of stuff. So trying to figure out how to size that index box was tough. And then, woe was you if that index box crashed and you had to turn the index role on someplace else and didn't have that amount of drive space somewhere. It really became a problem. So now with the cloud search service app, that index role, all those query files are sitting up in SharePoint Online. You don't have to plan your topology around that anymore. You don't have to plan topology around index servers or query servers, and you don't have to allocate drive space for them. So that's a good win right there. The other one, do you have more on that one?
Oh, I was just going to go into the really cool place of Office 365 Now, while you don't have to have as many servers on-prem to handle and as much disk space on-prem to handle crawling all of this and doing the, well, you have to do the crawl, but doing the indexing, this gives you the ability to start looking at Office 365 because there's some really good things that come out of this. Number one, the Office Graph, which is now the Microsoft Graph, and the Delve experience. So users can start to use Delve and start to experience it in a different way. It also starts to change the conversation as you're planning your topology about OneDrive. Should you be using OneDrive on-prem or OneDrive in Office 365? I postulate if you have the licensing, which in order to do the Cloud Search Service application, you must be licensed for Office 365 in order to see results. Not to use it, you can use it, it's just gonna return no results.
Yes.
So it's not really very useful, but you can go off and click buttons and it'll return a page. It's just not gonna have anything in it.
What you don't get is a helpful error message that says you're not licensed for search. You don't get that. What you do get is a confusing, you know, no results when you know stuff's there. I've gotten nailed by that myself. A couple of things to look at. If you haven't played with this yet, do not play with it in production. When you create this Cloud Search Service app, there's some PowerShell that goes on. There's some things that have to happen. And if you're doing things, it resets like your app realm and some things like that. Know what's going on, test it in a test environment first before you play with it much. And Microsoft, I can't remember what the limits are, but the limits for the size of your index in the cloud are huge. It's like a terabyte or something like that. So again, you don't have to worry much about that sizing. But here's the thing, Microsoft has all these great services that run in the cloud that are based on search. At some point, you're gonna want your on-prem data up there, or at least the indexes of it. So start looking at this now. It's not gonna be one of those things you're gonna be able to ignore, use.
So we need to keep moving because we're running short on time. We'll do Q&A at the end. We'll stick around as long as you guys want. Todd doesn't need to eat. I mean, he's lost so much weight. It's just the way he gets there. Me, I might, but we'll be okay. So we're just going to keep on moving here. From an infrastructure and networking design perspective, there are things to consider here. Let's make sure. There we go. So there are two different ways that I look at this. One is isolation of your traffic. Looking at saying, I want to keep my database separate from my web, separate from search, separate from the service application, separate from authentication, right? I can lower the traffic that's happening, I can lower the chattiness that's happening across all of these by adding additional NICs. As an architecture thing, I can add additional network cards, whether they're virtual or physical, depending upon if you're physical or virtual. You can also limit the number of hops at that point by going point to point and doing some specification there. You want to co-locate your servers, whether they're virtual or whether they're physical, it really doesn't matter. Especially in a SharePoint farm, they really do need to be close. That virtualization, it's especially important. Anything to add?
I'm good.
All right,
well,
let's
done.
Keep on moving. Some of my slides are coming in a little funny. From a physical perspective, there still is benefit to doing iron-based SharePoint servers. There's no virtualization overhead. While the virtualization overhead has dramatically come down, when I first started doing this topic, it was about 8%. Yeah. It is way lower now, but there still is an overhead there that you have to deal with. You're able to target specific databases to separate LUNs and physical spindles a lot easier than you are in virtualization. You have to have people who understand virtualization. If you don't, and you just have people who understand how to get SAN working, you can make this work. There is no OS limitation on the hardware, and networking is simple. I can add a NIC, I can plug in a network card, I add bandwidth. Nice and simple. The drawbacks, backup and recovery time. Obviously, it takes longer to back up a physical server than it does to back up a VM. You can, depending upon how you're mounting things, you're still dealing with that. The limited snapshot ability, if you're running SAN-based, there are SAN snaps that you can do, but trying to do a snapshot of a physical server is still something that's difficult and costly, and it is expensive to have iron these days, and you lack centralized management. You don't have that central console to see all the server is up and everything is there. You have to go in and manage each one unless you have purchased a product that is going to give that to you. There are lots of those. And budget constrained for failover options. Trying to do failover of physical servers, that is not cheap.
Or fun.
No. So from a virtualization perspective, the benefits obviously fairly counterbalance the physical. You get the ability to do snapshotting a lot simpler and a lot easier. When you're doing snapshotting, make sure that you delete those over time. You don't want to have a cascading set of snapshots. Personally, I'm a fan of, before I go off and do any big patching and updating, schedule a downtime window, do a copy of my VMs so I have a full federated copy, as opposed to trusting snapshot technology. It's great for quick rollback, but if you really are going to do major patching, make sure that you have a full copy rendered somewhere else. Rapid system deployment. I can set up templates and I can roll out servers, no problem. HR and DA, HA and DR capability, being able to fail servers over from one from one physical host as a virtual guest to another. You can do that very easily with a lot of virtualization technologies, and you do get centralized management at this point. The drawbacks, again, you have a loss of overhead for compute. That's just part of the reality that IO is, they have to run the base system at this point until we get to containerization. We're not there yet as far as SharePoint is concerned. You're not able to address the full hardware necessarily depending upon which version of virtualization you're using. You have centralized networking, right? So you're sharing potentially with other servers across the NIC and especially across the backplane going out to additional NICs. And you do have clustering complications out there as well.
How many of you install SharePoint on physical servers these days?
We got a couple.
More than I thought. That's
so,
good.
Let's talk about SQL performance. As I'd mentioned before, SQL is the brains of SharePoint. If the brain isn't working, nothing works, right? So if you aren't doing the right things in SQL, and as IT pros in the SharePoint space, a lot of times SQL is a fire and forget missile. We set it up and we don't want to think about it ever again. We set up our backups and everything just runs. I'm going to go off and I'm going to do all the other things that I actually know how to do a lot better because that SQL thing is tricky, okay? So one of the things that we want to make sure we do in order to make that possible for us to have lighter management of SQL, you still need to manage SQL, folks. It's just part of the reality. Whether you want to be a DBA or not, as a SharePoint admin, you kind of have to be, okay? I dislike it about myself.
Or at least be able to speak to the DBAs in a way that they will understand what you want them to do.
Yeah, yeah. So in order to do this, we want to pre-grow our databases. This is still a really good thing. SQL likes contiguous space, right? So if we can pre-grow our databases and say we know that we have X amount of content right now, if we're doing a migration, let's go ahead and plan. We've seen trend over time analysis. Let's give ourselves 25% overhead to be able to grow, and we have plenty of space in the database. Perfect, awesome stuff. Or if we're starting net new with a brand new SharePoint farm on-prem, let's go ahead and give it enough space, because if we just say, 100 meg is gonna be enough, right? That's gonna be perfect. Go ahead and give it plenty of space. Disks are fairly cheap these days. Need to keep going here, so I'm not gonna take more questions until a little bit later. Dramatic increase in performance when you do this, because that contiguous write is able to happen. If you're using spindle-based disks, this is key. If you're using flash disk, a lot less important these days, but when you have that ARM writing, being able to write contiguously across the stream, this is a lot more effective than this. It's just a hard operation. I'm tired doing that already. So, other things, auto growth. When it comes to auto growth, I like the fact that SQL has auto growth, but I really still dislike the fact that it defaults to 1 meg auto growth. Because what happens when you auto-grow a database, it pauses everything incoming in order to grow. So if I'm uploading a, let's call it a 400 meg file, it's gonna do a load, hit the limit, grow. Load, hit the limit, grow. And so you have this pause operation that's happening. It's pretty ugly. The other thing is, consider not doing grow by percent. Instead, manage SQL properly. Go ahead and set up a monitoring job to tell you when we've come within 10% of our available space, right? We want to take a look at that. And if we do hit the limit, go ahead and change that to grow by 50 meg or 100 meg so that it has that growth operation being done. You should never hit the end of your space in SQL. If you're monitoring properly, you should be able to get in there and get to it and grow it in off-peak times without having to impact the users. This is really key, because if you are growing and you say, I'm gonna set this and I want 25% free space in my database, and you get down to 10% and then you get the alert for 5%, what's happened? You have something going wrong in your farm. You need to be getting in there and taking a look, because you've overgrown your space. That's too rapid a growth if you're doing this right and monitoring properly.
Yeah, and I would say 500 meg to a gig growth. And like Jason said, if auto grow kicks in, that means someone's not doing their jobs. That's a bad thing.
So another piece from the SQL perspective, this is a great feature that came out, I want to say it's somewhere around the 2008 or 2 time. It might have been 2012.
I don't remember.
Not a true DBA, okay? So instant file initialization. So it used to be that we would have to write zeros to everything, and that was what that operation, the pause operation, was at the very beginning. Okay, now it's almost like, you know, you're just blowing air into the balloon and you get the space. Okay, so this is faster from an execution perspective, less pause at that point, but still having to grow and do these grow operations, it does take some time to do. So if you're growing by X, you know, let's say you're at a 200 gig database and you want to grow by 20%, that's still gonna be, I don't do math well, Todd, but I think that still is gonna be, you know, 40 gigs.
Yeah.
So that takes some time on disks to have to go off and grab that contiguous space, figure out where that space is, go off and grab as much as it can. Okay, so we don't have to do that write and rewrite operation anymore. It's much faster, but that's the reality. Log files cannot be done this way, though. That's important to note. So this is my handy-dandy, expensive SQL I/O table.
Are you all using your disk layouts in SQL like this, all 12?
Everybody doing it?
Drives, anybody? Anybody?
Yeah, of course. See this guy, yeah.
200 server guy, yeah. He's. Do you just have like hundreds burning in a pile somewhere? Yeah. So this is just nice to have. I don't know that I've ever seen anybody that actually has this, but this is the way to break out SQL for best performance. And like anything else, you know, best security, best performance, you do as much as you can with your constraints, budget, time, whatever. But these are the way you want to break things out. TempDB logs and databases on different drives, content database logs on different drives, optimized for reading and writing, things like that. Just a good handy slide.
Yeah, if you can only pick, let's call it two or three of these to do. Most important thing that you can put on its own set of spindles, anybody know? TempDB, there we go. Aww. If you can separate temp log out too, and if you can go off and split that TempDB by the number of cores you have, well, golly, that's pretty great too. Yeah. One of the wonderful things that SQL 2016 did for us was it actually puts that in the config wizard. It automatically goes off and looks at how many cores you have, and it makes that recommendation. Let's go ahead and split this button, you know, to the value of 3 because we have 4 cores. 0 being 1 in the SQL world because they're right. So when it comes to binary, at least. So that's if you can only do one, make sure you move TempDB, separate it out from your content. Everything will be happier because everything does go through that TempDB.
Yeah. One other thing is people get wrapped up on the content databases because that's where all the stuff is. All the things you want to do in SharePoint are in your content databases. The databases themselves don't have to be very fast. Because, I mean, reading, you want to respond well. But when you're uploading something to SharePoint, it doesn't go to the content DB. It goes to the content DB's transaction log. So those are the ones you want to be fast. You want those writes to be fast, the commits to be fast. We could do a whole session on this slide.
So a couple other things here. You want to talk about the content database sizing?
Yeah, so this is one of those things that's gotten a lot better. For SharePoint 2013 with current service packs and all that, in 2016, you can pretty easily have 200 gig content databases without much fuss. That's kind of the SharePoint for Dummies limit right there. If you don't want to have to think about SQL and think about performance and all that kind of stuff, if you keep your content databases below 200 gig, you're probably going to be okay. If you go out and find Microsoft's software boundaries and limitations document, they kind of break content databases into 3 tiers, and they tell you the next size up is 4 terabytes, and that's if you want to really start paying attention to it. You can have 4 terabyte content databases. And if you've got site collections that are archival only, you know, where documents go to die, things like that, those databases can be as big as you want them. And they're assuming things like there's no workflows running on this, things like that, those can have no limit. Now, here's what I'll tell you, and I stole this line from Chris Rock, one of his comedy specials a long time ago. Just because you can teach a bear to dance doesn't mean it's a good idea. Just because Microsoft says you can have a 4 terabyte content database doesn't mean it's a good idea, or an unlimited one. So there's more to this conversation than just Microsoft says it's supported. Can you back it up? Can you restore it? Can you put it in your test environment? Things like that to consider. And then your recovery model, that's the whole, you know, simple recovery model is your transactions are overwritten as they're committed, so you can't do any point in time recoveries. The full recovery model is the I want my logs to fill my hard drives setting. How many times have we seen that, everybody? Yeah, we've all seen that. If you need to do point in time recoveries, you need the full recovery model, but then you need to back your transaction logs up a lot, or else they will fill your drive up. Off to you, Mr. Himmelstein.
Yeah, you always worry me with that Chris Rock line. I never know whether we're going to talk about champagne or not.
So. There are many. Very few of them are suitable for
yes.
family.
Yes. So from a SQL Server performance perspective, this is a so all of this is sort of a religious argument, right, about SQL as to how do you do it, you know, how big should the content databases be, you know, well, who's the expert on it, what's the authority? Somebody says that it's always going to be this. Yeah, not so much. There's always an argument. There's always an answer to it. One of the things that you want to think about is how you isolate things. You know, the secure store database, good thing to still separate out from the rest of your farm as far as all the content is concerned. Personally, in a virtualization world, I like the idea of going ahead and putting the core databases into their own instance and letting them run, and then actually having the content databases separately, because one of the things that you can do at that point is do patching in slightly a different way, a little bit more uptime that you can get back to, because you cannot restore a ConfigDB. However, you can restore a SQL Server that has a ConfigDB on it. A little bit of a different idea.
Details.
Yes, so, just little things. So search and then highly transactional non-SharePoint databases, those should always be in a different SQL instance. They should not be living with SharePoint. That's why we were able to do instancing in SQL. You can keep it on the same box, but you want to separate that out from all of your databases in the same instance.
And does everybody know what Jason means when he says SQL instance? So this is the idea, like he said, you can have multiple SQL instances. That's bad, you shouldn't use a word in its own definition. But you could have multiple SQL processes running on the same hardware, but are completely different versions of SQL maybe, but different security model, different databases. They look like different SQL servers, though technically a SQL server is something you can kick. Mm-hmm. But you can have multiple instances of SQL, and that's what he's saying here. Have an instance of SQL that has content, has an instance of SQL that has config. That's an advanced move. You want to be careful with that one, but it's got some good benefits.
Yeah, this is more of an expert's kind of a thing. Make sure that before you make a choice this way,
yes.
Definitely is a monetary investment that you're making, but it is something that you can do. And from a performance perspective, if you're separating out SQL into different processes and you're able to do it onto different boxes, performance is only going to go up because you have less traffic happening to the same box. So, finally, we get to SharePoint performance.
13 minutes left. The part you all came here for. Go ahead.
All right, so from a tiered isolation perspective, separating via VLANs, we talked about this a little bit in a previous slide, talking about the chatter that happens and what you want to separate it out by NICs. So what are some of those things that can happen when you cross the VLAN line? You can get less chatter, so you're having lower latency happening because you have less chatter coming across the same NIC, but you increase your hop count at that point, right? Because you have to go out to a router to come back across. By co-locating all the SharePoint servers in the same VLAN, increased chatter, authentication traffic becomes a big thing. You want to think about that one being separate, but you do get a lower hop count at that point. So things get a lot faster when you're not having to go out. So the story behind this, I'll make it very brief, worked at a company. We had servers that we were trying to put on separate sides of the room, but always coming back through the same, being able to talk to each other. We're like, they're just across the room. It's going to be speedy. It's going to be fast. We have this new whole thing coming in. We just brought in new fiber. It's going to be great. Well, the servers on the right-hand side of the room were going back to the fiber switch right in the room. The servers on the left-hand side of the room were going back to a core switch, which went about a mile out and then came back. So all of that traffic was very slow. So we had to figure out how to make all of that work. Something you have to think about when you're doing this and co-locating, because we had things separated onto different VLANs, onto different switches. It was just got a little bit ugly and latency was very bad. So the key takeaway here is understand your network topology and then figure out your traffic requirements. Figure out your traffic requirements, figure it all out, and make sure that you're doing it in the right way based upon analytical data. So this topic is at the app tier layer. SharePoint load balances things very nicely at the app tier layer. It works really well. Concept here is know your load and then understand how to scale it based upon what you're seeing. So don't go blowing out your budget and buying 200 servers right out of the gates. Sorry,
unless you're hosting with Rackspace.
Unless you're hosting with Rackspace, then it's fine. Start and look at your world in a minimal fashion. If you're just getting started and you are starting net new into SharePoint on-prem, build out and start relatively small. Don't go planning, I'm gonna have 17 servers at the app tier layer because every service has to be separated, because you're probably never gonna touch most of that, right? At the web tier layer, you're probably gonna need more servers, but at the app tier layer, and the web tier layer doesn't load balance itself. You have to have load balancers out there. The app tier layer, understand what the load requirements are before you just go putting servers in. So find the choke point and then release the grasp. So you want to validate, not just assume, because budget just goes out the window at that point. So here is the example. I had this. This is a real world, real life example. I lived this. This was about 3 weeks of my life. This is the server farm that we had. We had two web servers, 4 cores, 16 gigs of RAM using NLB. Yes, we were using NLB. We had one app server, 4 cores, 16 gigs of RAM, and a SQL server instance that had 16 cores and 128 gigs of RAM dedicated to it. Okay? Simple CRUD operation. We were doing testing. This is something that's really important. Make sure you're doing proper testing. So we said, what are we gonna do? Well, we're gonna go ahead and do these, I believe it's 7 operations in order to do proper CRUD, log in, create a list item, open it, modify it, save it, delete it, log back out. Okay, we set up load testers, I believe we were using an HP product at the time, to go off and do as many users as we could. As we load test our environment, the response was, we got non-responsive at 500 concurrent users. That was not quite the performance that we were expecting. This is the most simple operation you can do in SharePoint. What in the world is going on? We had all of our custom code loaded in. We had all of our data loaded into the databases. So I took a red team in. We spent a week, and we just hammered at it. We looked through every bit of code. We looked through every line of SQL. We looked at every database. We looked at everything on the servers. Couldn't, you know, we found a whole bunch of things we could optimize. It was great. Went back, said, rerun that load test. We've done a week of work. Go rerun that load test. What happened? Exactly the same thing. Took the red team back into the room, said, guys, we're gonna add some people to this team. We went from 7 people to 14 people, so we had people looking over everybody's shoulders. We spent another week in the room. We said, we've got it now. We found more stuff. This is gonna be awesome. Rerun that load test. Same exact result. Came in the next day and I said, all right, I'm coming in for this load test. I went and I sat at my desk. And I opened up all my servers, and I wanted to see exactly what was going on. And I opened up this little thing. I right-clicked on the start menu. I went to Task Manager. I opened up, and I took a look. And as the load test happened, what happened? Found that we were CPU bound. We were in a virtual environment. We had how many cores? Each web server had 4 cores. So all we had to do at this point, instead of going back and seeing what was going on. SharePoint was hitting the box. We were going off SQL, we were doing all these things. We found we were CPU bound. So what did we do? Well, we added CPUs, and we added some web front ends. All of a sudden, the results were completely different. We got exactly what we were looking for. Had nothing to do with our code, had nothing to do with SQL, had nothing to do with the disk, had nothing to do with network. It was purely that we were CPU bound. Okay, so the reason why we've talked so much about the infrastructure of SharePoint here, and we talked about LUNs, and we talked about networking, and all of these things, is because you need a clean baseline. Okay, make sure that you start from a very clean baseline. You know that everything is working. Before you put a single line of custom code into an environment, you've run your tests. Know what the performance should be at every testing layer. Okay, that's the key here.
Yeah, and one thing I want to add to that is when you're doing the testing like this, understand that your bottleneck is a moving target. So in this environment, Jason found the bottleneck. It was the CPU. That didn't mean at that point he had no bottlenecks. That just meant it wasn't the CPU at that point. So now the bottleneck's going to move to be memory or disk I/O or network or something. Doing these kind of things, is you don't do it once and be done. It just keeps, it's a moving target.
Yeah. We spent 2 weeks in a room fixing developer bugs, right? There were plenty of things we needed to fix, but none of it mattered because we had a platform problem. As an IT pro in the SharePoint space, we can fix those. We can point fingers at the developers all we want, we can point fingers at the DBAs all we want, but if our platform isn't a baseline clean, it really doesn't help anything because none of it is going to matter. You're not going to be able to find any of the other things that are happening. There are always things that you can go off and fix, but you wanna make sure that your baseline is clean before you get started. So here are some tools. There are some that are free. You like Fiddler.
I like Fiddler. The thing I really like about Fiddler is, as a SharePoint administrator, I had an experience. I don't know if anybody else had this experience, but I would frequently get the call that SharePoint's slow. Does anybody get that anymore? Does that ever happen? Is that a thing? Okay, not just me, good. So one of the things I realized early on was that slow meant different things to different people. Fiddler is a free tool. It's a browser extension that I could run, I could have the end users run, but it will tell you exactly the amount of time that a page takes to load. Install Fiddler, go to your homepage, you can see exactly how long it took, you can see what all the calls were. It does two things. If you've got a big, 2 meg bitmap file somewhere on your page, it's gonna show you where that's at so you can shrink it. The other thing is, when you get that number and somebody says, SharePoint's slow, you can have them look at it and you can say, well, it only loaded in like 3 seconds. That's, it's well within our defined, we've set our benchmarks, we've got our parameters, and you're like, that's not slow, that's okay. Or, yes, it took 17 seconds, we've got a video embedded. So I'm a big fan of Fiddler.
Yeah, Microsoft Virtual Roundtrip Analyzer, it's a free tool from Microsoft. I'm a fan of that as well. It does very similar things to Fiddler. I find it to be a little bit more dumb JSON friendly. Don't have to debug quite as much. And then there are extensions, the developer tools inside of Chrome, Firefox, IE, and Edge. All four of them have developer tools that you can go off and do the same type of stuff. Now we're getting into the more expensive side of the world. Visual Studio Team Services, it costs money to have, but you do get 20,000 virtual user minutes every month to do load testing. So you have that. If you have an MSDN license, take a look and see which license you have, to see what you're authorized for in there, because you get some free stuff there.
How many of you guys went to the SharePoint conference in 2014? So Shane and I did a session on how to use this, how to set up Visual Studio to do load testing against your SharePoint farm. Sounds scary. We walk through it all. We do demos. Every one of you could set it up.
Yeah, that's Shane, guys. He's great. Mm-hmm. So Silk Performer, used it. Expensive tool, does a great job. HP's LoadRunner, same thing. Great testing tools, will simulate testing from all sorts of different locations. The Team Services does something similar as well. Yep. Those are more testing against your box as opposed to testing down to your box, so something a little bit different.
I was just thinking, I had one customer who was doing this, doing the load testing thing, and we didn't want to, it was a, an externally facing farm, we didn't want to mess with DNS, and so we took one of these web things and we pointed it at their URL and killed it. So, and of course we did it at like 9:30 on a Tuesday morning and just took it down just like that. So don't test these things in production. For us, it was, again, we didn't want to open another firewall and talk to the network guys. We're like, we'll just hit like 200 people at the, it'll be fine. It was not fine.
It's kind of important before you start load testing that you make sure somebody knows that you're gonna be load testing, because your network guys, they are gonna freak out because they've got monitors, most likely, network gals too,
yep.
They both
network folks.
Have monitoring. They're looking at it and going, somebody's doing a DDoS attack against me, because that's exactly what you're simulating at that point. Please, before you do it, save yourself some headaches and hassles. Make sure you've gotten authorization to do it. Doing the top three tools from your box, that's not gonna do anything. It's just taking a look at the traffic you're hitting, and you can see where, inside of the dev world, maybe somebody's loading images too big, and that's why things are slow. There's still the developer dashboard out there in the 2013, 2010 world that I'm a big fan of, but you have to scope that if you don't want everybody to see it, so different things you have to do. So these are some of the performance tools that we recommend that you consider taking a look at. There are others, there are probably some vendors out on the trade show floor as well that are doing great stuff. These are just ones that we've personally worked with, so the ones we can talk about. With that,
I think that's it.
I think we can get to a little bit of a quick reference. So Todd, you do a netcast or something.
I do blog every now and then, and I do the podcast at 5 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Central. Yep. We talked a little bit, so I'll let Jason hit his blog in a second. We do that zero downtime patching. Watch that video. Even if you don't think you're gonna do ZDP, watch that video to understand they've made some changes in patching and it's pretty good stuff. The other thing is I've got that builds page down there for all the 2016 patches. So far, we're like 5-6 months in, there have been no regressions with the SharePoint 2016 patch. Right now, as of today, September 29th, 2016, CE, There have been no regressions with SharePoint 2016 patches, but that's where you can keep up to date on that.
And you've got a 2013 and a 2010 builds page as well out there in case you're on all of the older ones. So that's my blog, SharePointLonghorn.com. John White and I are getting ready to do a lot more around the bifocal show, so bifocal.show. Take a look at that in a couple weeks. We'll have some information for you if you're interested in BI or you just want to hear John talk, because I know you're tired of me by now. Yeah, the ZDP thing. Neil Hodgkinson's just really a super smart guy and explains things in a very cool way. So make sure you go out and take a look at it. With that, please do the evals so we can know how much you love Todd. If you want a hug, he has the. Do we still have some hug stickers?
We have.
There are still available today, as of right now. Sorry for those of you who are watching this online. We have I Hug Todd Clint stickers. If you want one, they're limited edition.
This was not my idea, folks. I swear to you, I had no part of it.
He has them in his bag. So make sure if you give Todd a hug, go give him a hug. You get one. Please do give us the ratings and let us know what you thought of the session. Thank you very much. We'll stick around and take Q&A.